well for yourself, haven't you? Stop it, Willie!" he added in a loud aside to the eager collie, which was still pulling on its lead, trying to regain the road.
"Oh aye, Margaret follows everything you do, all the stories in the papers. You found out who killed that model girl, and that writer. Margaret's never forgot what you did for her girl, never."
Strike muttered something indistinct, something he hoped sounded grateful for Margaret's appreciation.
"What for are you wanting to talk to old Mrs. Lang? He's nae done something else, has he, Donnie?"
"I am trying to find him," said Strike evasively. "Do you know if he's back in Melrose?"
"Och, no, I wouldna think so. He came back to see his mother a few years back, but I dinna know that he's been here since. It's a small town. Donnie Lang back. We'd hear, ken."
"Do you think Mrs. Bunyan, did you say, might have any—"
"She'd love to meet you," said the old man excitedly.
"No, Willie," he added to the whining border collie, which was trying to tug him to the gate.
"I'll ring her, will I? She's only over in Durnock, next village. Will I ring?"
"That'd be very helpful." So Strike accompanied the old man next door and waited in a small spotless sitting room while he gabbled excitedly into the phone over his dog's increasingly furious whines.
"She'll come over," said the old man, with his hand over the receiver. "Do you want to meet her here? You're welcome. The wife'll make tea."
"Thanks, but I got a couple of things to do," lied Strike, who doubted the possibility of a successful interview in the presence of this garrulous witness. "Could you see whether she'd be free for a lunch at the Ship Inn in an hour?" The collie's determination for its walk tipped the balance in Strike's favour. The two men left the house and walked back down the hill together, the collie tugging all the way, so that Strike was forced into a faster gait than suited him on a steep downward slope. He said goodbye with relief to his helpful acquaintance in Market Square. With a cheery wave, the old man headed off in the direction of the River Tweed, and Strike, now limping slightly, walked down the high street, killing time until he needed to return to the ship. At the bottom of the road, he encountered another explosion of black and acid yellow, which, Strike realized, explained the Ship Inn's colours. Here again was the yellow rose, on a sign announcing Melrose Rugby Football Club. Strike paused, hands in pockets, looking over the low wall at a smooth, level expanse of viridian velvet surrounded by trees, the yellow rugby posts shining in the sun, stands to the right and softly undulating hills beyond. The pitch was as well maintained as any place of worship, and an extraordinarily well-appointed facility for such a small town. Staring out across the expanse of velvety grass, Strike remembered Whittaker, stinking and smoking in the corner of the squat, while Leda lay beside him, listening open-mouthed to the tales of his hard life, credulous and greedy as a baby bird, as Strike now saw it, for the yarns Whittaker spun her. From Leda's point of view, Gordonston might as well have been Alcatraz. It was nothing short of outrageous that her slender poet had been forced out into the harsh Scottish winter to be pummeled and knocked about in the mud and the rain.
"Not rugby, darling. Oh, poor baby. You playing rugby."
And when the 17-year-old Strike, sporting a fat lip from the boxing club at the time, had laughed, softly, into his homework, Whittaker had staggered to his feet, shouting in his obnoxious mockney,
"What are you fucking laughing about, meathead?"
Whittaker could not stand laughter at his expense. He needed, craved, adulation. In its absence, he would take fear or even loathing as evidence of his power, but ridicule was evidence of another's assumed superiority, and consequently unbearable.
"You'd fucking love it, wouldn't you, you stupid little tit? Think you're fucking officer class already, don't you? Out with the rugger buggers. Get his rich daddy to send it to fucking Gordonston."
Whittaker had yelled at Leda.
"Calm down, darling,"
she had said, and then in slightly more peremptory terms,
"No, Corm."
Strike had stood up, braced, ready and eager to hit Whittaker. That had been the closest he had ever come to doing it, but his mother had staggered between them
a thin beringed hand on each heaving chest. Strike blinked, and the bright sunlit pitch, a place of innocent endeavour and excitement, seemed to come back into focus. He could smell leaves, grass, and the warm rubber from the road beside him. Slowly he turned and headed back towards the Ship Inn, craving a drink, but his treacherous subconscious was not done with him yet. The sight of that smooth rugby pitch had unleashed another memory. Black-haired, dark-eyed Noel Brockbank, running at him with a broken beer bottle in his hand. Brockbank had been massive, powerful, and fast. A flanker. Strike remembered his own fist rising around the side of that broken bottle, connecting just as the glass touched his own neck. A basal skull fracture, that's what they had called it. Bleeding from the ear, a massive brain injury. "Fuck, fuck, fuck," mumbled Strike under his breath, in time with his own footsteps. "Lang, that's what you're here for, Lang." He passed under the metal galleon with bright yellow sails that hung over the Ship Inn's door. A sign just inside read, "Melrose's Only Pub." He found the place instantly calming, a glow of warm colour, shining glass and brass. A carpet that resembled a patchwork of faded browns, reds and greens, walls of warm peach and exposed stone. Everywhere were more indications of Melrose's sporting obsession. Blackboards announcing upcoming matches, several enormous plasma screens, and, above the urinal, it had been hours since Strike had last peed, a small, wall-mounted television, just in case a try was pending at the point a full bladder could no longer be ignored. Mindful of the journey back to Edinburgh in Hardacre's car, he bought himself half a pint of John Smith's and sat down on a leather-covered sofa facing the bar, perusing the laminated menu and hoping that Margaret Bunyan would be punctual, because he had just realised that he was hungry. She appeared a mere 5 minutes later. Although he could barely remember what her daughter looked like, and had never met Mrs. Bunyan before, her expression of mingled apprehension and anticipation gave her away as she paused, staring at him, on the doormat. Strike got up, and she stumbled forwards, both hands gripping the strap of a large black handbag.
"It is you," she said breathlessly.
She was around 60, small and fragile-looking, wearing metal-framed glasses, her expression anxious beneath tightly permed fair hair. Strike held out a large hand and shook hers, which trembled slightly, cold and fine-boned.
"Her dad's over in Hawick today. He can't come. I rang him. He said to tell you we'll never forget what you did for Rona,"
she said on a single breath. She sank down beside Strike on the sofa, continuing to observe him with mingled awe and nerves.
"We've never forgot. We read about you in the papers. We were so sorry about your leg. What you did for Rona. What you did."
Her eyes were suddenly brimful of tears.
"We were so..."
"I'm glad I was able to..."
Find her child tied naked and bloodstained on a bed. Talking to relatives about what the people they loved had endured was one of the worst parts of the job.
"Able to help her."
Mrs. Bunyan blew her nose on a handkerchief, retrieved from the bottom of her black handbag. He could tell that she was of the generation of women who would never usually enter a pub alone, and certainly not buy drinks at a bar if a man were there to undertake the ordeal for them.
"Let me get you something."
"Just an orange juice,"
she said breathlessly, dabbing at her eyes.
"And something to eat?"
Strike urged, keen to order the beer-battered haddock and chips for himself. When he had placed their order at the bar and returned to her, she asked what he was doing in Melrose, and the source of her nervousness became apparent at once.
"He's not come back, has he, Donny? Is he back?"
"Not as far as I know," said Strike. "I don't know where he is."
"Do you think he's got something to do—"
Her voice had dropped to a whisper.
"We read in the paper. We saw that someone sent you a—"
"Yes,"
said Strike. I don't know whether he's got anything to do with it, but I'd like to find him. Apparently he's been back here to see his mother since leaving jail.
Oh, 4 or 5 years ago that would have been, said Margaret Bunyan. He turned up on her doorstep, forced his way into the bungalow. She's got Alzheimer's now. She couldn't stop him. But the neighbours called his brothers and they came and threw him out.
They did they?
Donnie's the youngest. He's got 4 older brothers. They're hard men, said Mrs. Bunyan. All of them. Jamie stays in Selkirk. He came tearing through to get Donnie out of his mother's house. They say he knocked him senseless.
She took a tremulous sip of her orange juice and continued.
We heard all about it. Our friend Brian, who you just met, he saw the fight happening out in the street. 4 of them onto 1, all of them shouting and yelling. Someone called the police.
Jamie got the caution. He didn't care, said Mrs. Bunyan.
They didn't want him anywhere near them or their mother. They ran him out of town. I was terrified, she continued, for Rona. He'd always said he'd find her when he got out.
And did he? Asked Strike.
Och, yes, said Margaret Bunyan miserably. We knew he would. She'd moved to Glasgow, got a job in a travel agent's. He still found her. 6 months she lived in fear of him turning up, and then one day he did. Came to her flat one night. But he'd been ill. He wasn't the same.
Ill? Repeated Strike sharply.
I can't remember what it was he got, some kind of arthritis, I think, and Rona said he'd put on a lot of weight. He turned up at her flat at night, he tracked her down, but thanks be to God, said Mrs. Bunyan fervently. Her fiancé was staying over. His name's Ben, she added, with a triumphal flourish, the colour high in her faded cheeks. And he's a policeman.
She said it as though she thought Strike would be especially glad to hear this, as though he and Ben were co-members of some great investigative brotherhood.
They're married now, said Mrs. Bunyan. No kids because, well, you know why.
And without warning, a torrent of tears burst forth, streaming down Mrs. Bunyan's face behind her glasses. The horror of what had happened a decade ago was suddenly fresh and raw, as though a pile of offal had been dumped on the table in front of them.
Lang stuck a knife up inside her, whispered Mrs. Bunyan.
She confided in him as though Strike were a doctor or a priest, telling him the secrets that weighed on her, but which she could not tell her friends. He already knew the worst. As she groped again for the handkerchief in her square black bag, Strike remembered the wide patch of blood on the sheets, the excoriated skin on her wrist where Rona had tried to free herself. Thank God her mother could not see inside his head.
He stuck a knife inside, and they tried to, you know, repair.
Mrs. Bunyan took a deep, shuddering breath as 2 plates of food appeared in front of them.
But she and Ben have lovely holidays, she whispered frantically,
dabbing repeatedly at her hollow cheeks, lifting her glasses to reach her eyes.
And they breed German shepherds.
Hungry though he was, Strike could not eat in the immediate aftermath of discussing what had been done to Rona Lang.
She and Lang had a baby, didn't they? He asked, remembering its feeble whimpering from beside its blood-stained, dehydrated mother. The kid must be what, 10 by now?
He died,
she whispered, tears dripping off the end of her chin.
Caught death. He was always sickly, the bairn. It happened 2 days after they put Donnie away, and Donnie, he telephoned her out of jail and told her he knew she'd killed the babby, and that he'd kill her when he got out.
Strike laid a large hand briefly on the sobbing woman's shoulder, then hoisted himself to his feet and approached the young barmaid who was watching them with her mouth open. Brandy seemed too strong for the sparrow-like creature behind him. Strike's Aunt Joan, who was only a little older than Mrs. Bunyan, always regarded port as medicinal. He ordered a glass and took it back to her. Here, drink this. His reward was a recrudescence of tears. But after much more dabbing with a sodden handkerchief, she said shakily,
You're very kind.
Sipped it, gave a little gasping sigh and blinked at him, her fair-lashed eyes pink like a piglet's.
Have you got any idea where Lang went after turning up at Rona's?
Yes,
she whispered.
Ben put out feelers through work, through the probation office. Apparently he went to Gateshead, but I don't know whether he's still there.
Gateshead.
Strike remembered the Donald Lang he had found online. Had he moved from Gateshead to Corby, or were they different men?
Anyway, said Mrs. Bunyan, he's never bothered Rona and Ben again.
I'll bet he hasn't, said Strike, picking up his knife and fork. A copper and German shepherds, eh? He's not stupid.
She seemed to take courage and comfort from his words, and with a timid, tearful smile, began to pick at her macaroni cheese.
They married young, commented Strike,
who was keen to hear anything he could about Lang, anything that might give a lead on his associations or habits. She nodded, swallowed, and said,
Far too young. She started seeing him when she was only 15, and we didn't like it. We'd heard things about Donnie Lang. There was a young girl who said he'd forced himself on her at the Young Farmers' Disco. It never came to anything. The police said there wasn't enough evidence. We tried to warn Rona she was in trouble. She sighed. But that made her more determined. She was always headstrong, our Rona.
He'd already been accused of rape? Asked Strike.
His fish and chips were excellent. The pub was filling up, for which he was grateful. The barmaid's attention was diverted from them.
Oh yes, they're a rough family, said Mrs. Bunyan,
with a sort of prim small-town snobbery that Strike knew well from his own upbringing.
Oh, those brothers, they were always fighting, in trouble with the police, but he was the worst of them. His own brothers didn't like him. I don't think his mother liked him much, to tell the truth. There was a rumour, she said in a burst of confidence, that he was near the father's. The parents were always fighting, and they separated round about the time she got pregnant with Donnie. They say she had a run-around with one of the local policemen, as a matter of fact. I don't know whether it's true. The policeman moved on and Mr. Lang moved back in, but Mr. Lang never liked Donnie, I know that. Never liked him at all. People said it was because he knew Donnie wasn't his. He was the wildest of all of them, a big lad. He got into the junior sevens.
Sevens?
The rugby sevens, she said.
And even this small, genteel lady was surprised that Strike did not immediately understand what, to Melrose, seemed more religion than sport.
But they kicked him out. No discipline.
Someone carved up Greenyards the week after they kicked him out.
The pitch, she added, in response to the Englishman's mystifying ignorance. The port was making her talkative. Words were tumbling out of her now.
He took up boxing instead. He had the gift of the gab, though, oh aye. When Rona first took up with him, she was 15 and he was 17. I had some folk telling me he wasn't a bad lad, really. Oh, aye,
she repeated, nodding at Strike's look of disbelief. Folk that didn't know him so well were took in by him. He could be charming when he wanted to, Donnie Lang.
But you just ask Walter Gilchrist whether he was charming. Walter sacked him off the farm. He was always being late, and someone set fire to his barn after. Oh, they never proved it was Donnie. They never proved it was him who wrecked the pitch, neither, but I know what I believe. Rona wouldn't listen. She thought she knew him. He was misunderstood, and I don't know what else. We were prejudiced, narrow-minded. He wanted to join the army. Good riddance, I thought. I hope she'd forget him if he left. Then he came back. He got her pregnant, but she lost it. She was angry with me because I said...
She did not want to tell him what she had said, but Strike could imagine.
And then she wouldn't talk to me anymore. And she went and married him on his next leave. Her dad and I weren't invited, she said. Off to Cyprus together. But I know he killed our cat.
What?
said Strike, thrown. I know it was him. We told Rona she was making an awful mistake last time we saw her before she married him. That night we couldn't find Purdy. Next day she was on the back lawn, dead. The vet said she'd been strangled. On the plasma screen over her shoulder, a scarlet-clad Dimitar Berbatov was celebrating a goal against Fulham. The air was full of boarders' voices. Glasses clinked and cutlery tinkled as Strike's companion talked of death and mutilation. "I know he did it. I know he killed Purdy," she said feverishly. "Look at what he did to Rona and the babby. He's evil." Her hands fumbled with a catch on her bag and pulled out a small wad of photographs. "My husband always says, 'Why are you keeping them? Burn them.' But I always thought we might need pictures of him one day. There," she said, thrusting them into Strike's eager hands. "You have them, you keep them. Gateshead, that's where he went next." Later, after she had left with renewed tears and thanks, after he had paid the bill, Strike walked to Miller's of Melrose, a family butcher he had noticed on his stroll around the town. There he treated himself to some venison pies that he suspected would be far tastier than anything he would be able to purchase at the station before boarding the sleeper back to London. Returning to the car park via a short street where golden roses bloomed, Strike thought again about the tattoo on that powerful forearm. Once, years ago, it had meant something to Donnie Lang to belong to this lovely town, surrounded by farmland and overlooked by the triple peaks of Eildon Hill. Yet he had been no straightforward worker of the soil, no team player, no asset to a place that seemed to pride itself on discipline and honest endeavour. Melrose had spat out the burner of barns, the strangler of cats, the carver-up of rugby fields, so Lang had taken refuge in a place where many men had found either their salvation or their inevitable comeuppance. The British Army. When that had led to jail, and jail disgorged him, he had tried to come home, but nobody had wanted him. Had Donald Lang found a warmer welcome in Gateshead? Had he moved from there to Corby? Or, Strike wondered, as he folded himself back into Hardacre's Mini, had these been mere stopping posts on his way to London and Strike? Chapter 17. The Girl That Love Made Blind. Tuesday morning. It was asleep, after what It said had been a long, hard night. Like he fucking cared. Although he had to act like he did. He had persuaded It to go and lie down, and when It began to breathe deeply and evenly, he watched It for a while, imagining choking the fucking life out of It, seeing Its eyes open and It struggle for breath, Its face slowly turning purple. When he had been sure that he would not wake It, he had left the bedroom quietly, pulled on a jacket, and slipped out into the early morning air to find the secretary. This was his first chance of following her in days, and he was too late to pick up the trail at her home station. The best he could do was lurk around the mouth of Denmark Street. He spotted her from a distance. That bright, wavy, strawberry blonde head was unmistakable. The vain bitch must like standing out in the crowd, or she'd cover it, or cut it, or dye it. They all wanted attention, he knew that for a fact. All of them. As she moved closer, his infallible instinct for other people's moods told him something had changed. She was looking down as she walked, hunch-shouldered, oblivious to the other workers swarming around her, clutching bags, coffees and phones. He passed right by her in the opposite direction, drawing so close that he could have smelled her perfume if they had not been in that bustling street full of car fumes and dust. He might have been a traffic bollard. That annoyed him a little, even though it had been his intention to pass by her unnoticed. He had singled her out, but she treated him with indifference. On the other hand, he had made a discovery. She had been crying for hours. He knew what it looked like when women did that. He had seen it plenty of times. Puffy and reddened and flabby-faced, leaking and whining. They all did it. They liked playing the victim. You'd kill them just to make them shut up. He turned and followed her the short distance to Denmark Street. When women were in her state, they were often malleable in ways they would not be when less distressed or frightened. They forgot to do all the things that bitches did routinely to keep the likes of him at bay. Keys between their knuckles, phones in their hands, rape alarms in their pockets, walking in packs. They became needy, grateful for a kind word, a friendly ear. That was how he had landed it. His pace quickened as she turned into Denmark Street, which the press had at last given up as a bad job after 8 days. She opened the black door of the office and went inside. Would she come out again, or was she going to spend the day with Strike? He really hoped they were screwing each other. They probably were. Just the two of them in the office all the time. Bound to be. He withdrew into a doorway and pulled out his phone, keeping one eye on the second floor window of number 24. Chapter 18. I've been stripped. The insulation's gone. Blue Oyster Cult. Lips in the Hills. The first time that Robin had ever entered Strike's office had been on her first morning as an engaged woman. Unlocking the glass door today, she remembered watching the new sapphire on her finger darken shortly before Strike had come hurtling out of the office and nearly knocked her down the metal staircase to her death. There was no ring on her finger anymore. The place where it had sat all these months felt hypersensitive, as though it had left her branded. She was carrying a small holdall that contained a change of outfit and a few toiletries. You can't cry here. You mustn't cry here. Automatically, she performed the usual start of the working day tasks, took off her coat, hung it up with a handbag on a peg beside the door, filled and switched on the kettle, and stowed the holdall under her desk, where Strike would not see it. She kept turning back to check that she'd done what she had meant to do, feeling disembodied, like a ghost whose chilly fingers might slip through the handles of handbags and kettles. It had taken 4 days to dismantle a relationship that had lasted 9 years. 4 days of mounting animosity, of grudges aired and accusations hurled. Some of it seemed so trivial, looking back. The Land Rover, the Grand National, her decision to take her laptop home. On Sunday, there had been a petty squabble about whose parents were paying for the wedding cars, which had led yet again to an argument about her pitiful pay packet. By the time they had got into the Land Rover on Monday morning to drive back home, they had barely been speaking. Then last night, at home in West Ealing, had come the explosive argument that had rendered all the squabbling that had gone before trivial, mere warning tremors of the seismic disaster that would lay waste to everything. Strike would be down shortly. She could hear him moving around in the flat upstairs. Robin knew that she must not look shaky or unable to cope. Work was all she had now. She would have to find a room in somebody else's flat, which would be all she would be able to afford on the pittance Strike paid her. She tried to imagine future housemates. It would be like being back in halls of residence. Don't think about that now. As she made tea, she realized that she had forgotten to bring in a tin of Betty's tea bags she had bought shortly after trying on her wedding dress for the last time. The thought almost overset her, but by powerful effort of will, she restrained the urge to cry and took her mug to the computer, ready to trawl through the emails she had not been able to answer during their week of exile from the office. Strike, she knew, had only just got back from Scotland. He had returned on the overnight train. She would make conversation about that when he appeared, so as to keep attention away from her red, swollen eyes. Before leaving the flat this morning, she had tried to improve their appearance with ice and cold water, but with limited success. Matthew had tried to block her path as she headed out of the flat. He had looked ghastly, too. Look, we've got to talk. We've got to. Not anymore, thought Robin. whose hand shook as she lifted the hot tea to her lips. I haven't got to do anything I don't want to do any more. The brave thought was undermined by a single hot tear that leaked without warning down her cheek. Horrified, she brushed it away. She had not thought that she had any tears left to cry. Turning to her monitor, she began typing a reply to a client who had queried his invoice, hardly knowing what she wrote. Clanging footsteps on the stairs outside made her brace herself. The door opened. Robin looked up. The man who stood there was not Strike. Primal instinctive fear ripped through her. There was no time to analyze why the stranger had such an effect on her. She only knew that he was dangerous. In an instant, she had calculated that she would not be able to reach the door in time, that her rape alarm was in her coat pocket, and that her best weapon was the sharp letter opener lying inches from her left hand. He was gaunt and pale. His head was shaven. A few freckles were scattered across a broad nose, and his mouth was wide and thick-lipped. Tattoos covered his wrists, knuckles, and neck. A gold tooth glinted on one side of his grinning mouth. A deep scar ran from the middle of his upper lip towards his cheekbone, dragging his mouth upwards in a permanent Elvis-style sneer. He wore baggy jeans and a tracksuit top, and he smelled strongly of stale tobacco and cannabis.
"Sup,"
he said. He repeatedly clicked the fingers of both hands hanging at his sides as he moved into the room. Click, click, click.
"You all alone, yeah?"
"No,"
she said, her mouth completely dry. She wanted to grab the letter opener before he came any closer.
Click, click, click. "My boss is just..."
"Shanker!"
said Strike's voice from the doorway. The stranger turned.
"Banson,"
he said, and stopped clicking his fingers, held out a hand and gave Strike a dap greeting.
"How you doing, bruv?"
"Dear God,"
thought Robin, limp with relief. Why hadn't Strike told her that the man was coming? She turned away, busying herself with email so that Strike would not see her face. As Strike led Shanker into the inner office and closed the door behind them, she caught the word Whittaker. Ordinarily, she would have wished that she could be in there listening. She finished her email and supposed that she ought to offer them coffee. First, she went to splash more cold water on her face in the tiny bathroom on the landing, which retained a strong smell of drains, no matter how many air fresheners she bought out of petty cash. Strike, meanwhile, had seen just enough of Robin to be shocked by her appearance. He had never seen her face so pale, nor her eyes so puffy and bloodshot. Even as he sat down at his desk, eager to hear what information on Whittaker Shanker had brought to his office, the thought crossed his mind, what's the bastard done to her? And for a fraction of a second, before fixing all his attention on Shanker, Strike imagined punching Matthew and enjoying it.
"Why are you looking so ugly, Bunsen?"
asked Shanker, stretching himself out on the chair opposite and clicking his fingers enthusiastically. He had had the tic since his teens, and Strike pitied the person who would try to make him stop.
"Knackered," said Strike. "Got back from Scotland a couple of hours ago."
"Never been to Scotland,"
said Shanker. Strike was not aware that Shanker had ever been out of London in his life.
"So, what have you got for me?"
"He's still around,"
said Shanker, ceasing his finger-clicking to pull a pack of Mayfairs out of his pocket. He lit one with a cheap lighter without asking whether Strike minded. With a mental shrug, Strike took out his own Benson and Hedges and borrowed the lighter.
"Seen his dealer. Geezer says he's in Catford."
"He's left Hackney."
"Unless he left a clone of himself behind, he must have done, Bunsen. I didn't check for clones. Give me another ton and I'll go see."
Strike gave a short snort of amusement. People underestimated Shanker at their peril. Given that he looked as though he had done every kind of illegal substance in his time, his restlessness often misled acquaintances into assuming he was on something. In fact, he was sharper and soberer than many a businessman at the end of their working day, if incurably criminal.
"Got an address?"
said Strike, pulling a notebook towards him.
Not yet,
said Shanker.
Is he working?
He tells everyone he's a road manager for some metal band.
But?
He's pimping,
said Shanker matter-of-factly. There was a knock on the door.
Anyone want coffee?
Asked Robin. Strike could tell that she was deliberately keeping her face out of the light. His eyes found her left hand. The engagement ring was missing.
Cheers, said Shanker. Two sugars.
Tea would be great, thanks, said Strike, watching her move away as he reached into his desk for the old tin ashtray he had swiped from a bar in Germany.
He pushed it across to Shanker before the latter could tap his lengthening ash on the floor.
How do you know he's pimping?
I know this other geezer who met him with the brass, said Shanker.
Strike was familiar with the Cockney slang, brass nail, tail.
Says Whittaker lives with her, very young, just legal.
Right, said Strike.
He had dealt with prostitution and its various aspects ever since he had become an investigator, but this was different. This was his ex-stepfather, a man whom his mother had loved and romanticized, to whom she had borne a child. He could almost smell Whittaker in the room again, his filthy clothes, his animal stink.
Catford, he repeated.
Yeah, I'll keep looking if you want, said Shanker,
disregarding the ashtray and flicking his ash onto the floor.
How much is it worth to you, Banson?
While they were still negotiating Shanker's fee, a discussion that proceeded with good humour but the underlying seriousness of two men who knew perfectly well that he would do nothing without payment, Robin brought in the coffee. With the light full on her face, she looked ghastly.
I've done the most important emails, she told Strike, pretending not to notice his inquiring look. I'll head off and do platinum now.
Shanker looked thoroughly intrigued by this announcement, but nobody explained.
You okay?
Strike asked her, wishing that Shanker were not present.
Fine,
said Robin, with a pathetic attempt at a smile.
I'll catch up with you later. Head off and do platinum?
Repeated Shanker curiously, over the sound of the outer door closing.
It's not as good as it sounds, said Strike, leaning back in his seat to look out of the window.
Robin left the building in her trench coat and headed off up Denmark Street and out of sight. A large man in a beanie hat came out of the guitar shop opposite and set off in the same direction. But Strike's attention had already been recalled by Shanker, who said,
Someone really sent you a fucking leg, Bunsen?
Yep, said Strike. Cut it off, boxed it up, and delivered it by hand.
Fuck me backwards, said Shanker,
whom it took a great deal to shock. After Shanker had left, in possession of a wad of cash for services already rendered, and the promise of the same again for further details on Whittaker, Strike phoned Robin. She did not pick up, but that wasn't unusual if she was somewhere she couldn't easily talk. He texted her, Let me know when you're somewhere I can meet you. Then sat down in her vacated chair, ready to do his fair share of answering inquiries and paying invoices. However, he found it hard to focus after the second night on a sleeper. 5 minutes later he checked his mobile, but Robin had not responded, so he got up to make himself another mug of tea. As he raised the mug to his lips, he caught a faint whiff of cannabis, transferred from hand to hand as he and Shanker said farewell. Shanker came originally from Canning Town, but had cousins in Whitechapel who, 20 years previously, had become involved in a feud with a rival gang. Shanker's willingness to help out his cousins had resulted in him lying alone in the gutter at the end of Fulbourne Street, bleeding copiously from the deep gash to his mouth and cheek that disfigured him to this day. It was there that Leda Strike, returning from a late evening excursion to purchase Rizzlers, had found him. To walk past a boy of her own son's age while he lay bleeding in the gutter would have been impossible for Leda. The fact that the boy was clutching a bloody knife that he was screaming imprecations and clearly in the grip of some kind of drug made no difference at all. Shankar found himself being mopped up and talked to as he had not been talked to since his own mother had died when he was 8. When he refused point blank to let the strange woman call an ambulance for fear of what the police would do to him, Shankar had just stuck his knife through the thigh of his attacker. Leda took what, to her, was the only possible course. She helped him home to the squat and looked after him personally. After cutting up band-aids and sticking them clumsily over the deep cut in a semblance of stitches, she cooked him a sloppy mess full of cigarette ash and told her bemused son to find a mattress where Shankar could sleep. Leda treated Shankar from the first as though he were a long-lost nephew, and in return he had worshipped her in the way that only a broken boy clinging to the memory of a loving mother could. Once healed, he availed himself of her sincere invitation to drop round whenever he felt like it. Shankar talked to Leda as he could talk to no other human being, and was perhaps the only person who could see no flaw in her. To Strike, he extended the respect he felt for his mother. The two boys, who in almost every other regard were as different as it was possible to be, were further bonded by a silent but powerful hatred of Whittaker, who had been insanely jealous of the new element in Leda's life, but wary of treating him with the disdain he showed Strike. Strike was sure that Whittaker had recognized in Shankar the same deficit from which he himself suffered, a lack of normal boundaries. Whittaker had concluded, rightly, that his teenage stepson might well wish him dead, but that he was restrained by a desire not to distress his mother, a respect for the law, and a determination not to make an irrevocable move that would forever blight his own prospects. Shankar, however, knew no such restraints, and his long periods of cohabitation with the fractured family kept a precarious curb on Whittaker's growing tendency towards violence. In fact, it had been the regular presence of Shankar in the squat that had made Strike feel he could safely leave for university. He had not felt equal to putting into words what he most feared when he took leave of Shankar, but Shankar had understood.
"No worries, Bunsen, mate. No worries."
Nevertheless, he could not always be there. On the day that Leda had died, Shankar had been away on one of his regular drug-related business trips. Strike would never forget Shankar's grief, his guilt, his uncontrollable tears when they next met. While Shankar had been negotiating a good price for a kilo of premium Bolivian cocaine in Kentish Town, Leda Strike had been slowly stiffening on a filthy mattress. The finding of the post-mortem was that she had ceased to breathe a full 6 hours before any of the other squat dwellers tried to rouse her from what they thought was a profound slumber. Like Strike, Shankar had been convinced from the first that Whittaker had killed her, and such was the violence of his grief and his desire for instant retribution that Whittaker might well have been glad he was taken into custody before Shankar could get his hands on him. Inadvisably allowed into the witness box to describe a maternal woman who had never touched heroin in her life, Shankar had screamed,
"That fucker done it!"
attempted to clamber over the barrier towards Whittaker and been bundled unceremoniously out of court. Consciously pushing away these memories of the long-buried past, which smelled no better for being dug up again, Strike took a swig of hot tea and checked his mobile again. There was still no word from Robin. Chapter 19. Workshop of the Telescopes. He had known the second he laid eyes on the secretary that morning that she was out of kilter, off balance. Looking at her, sitting in the window of the Garrick, the large students' restaurant serving the LSE, she was plain today, puffy, red-eyed, pale. He could probably take the seat next to her, and the stupid bitch wouldn't notice. Concentrating on the tart with the silver hair, who was working on a laptop a few tables away, she had no attention to spare for men. Suited him. She'd be noticing him before long. he'd be her last sight on Earth. He didn't need to look like Pretty Boy today. He never approached them sexually if they were upset. That was when he became the friend in need, the avuncular stranger. Not all men are like that, darling. You deserve better. Let me walk you home. Come on, I'll give you a lift. You could do almost anything with them if you made them forget you had a dick. He entered the crowded restaurant, skulking around the counter, buying a coffee and finding himself a corner where he could watch her from behind. Her engagement ring was missing. That was interesting. It shone a new light on the holdall she had been alternately carrying over her shoulder and hiding under tables. Was she planning to sleep somewhere other than the flat in Ealing? Might she be heading down a deserted street for once, a shortcut with poor lighting, a lonely underpass? The very first time he'd killed had been like that. A simple question of seizing the moment. He remembered it in snapshots, like a slideshow, because it had been thrilling and new. That was before he had honed it to an art, before he had started playing it like the game it was. She'd been plump and dark. Her mate had just left, got into a punter's car and disappeared. The bloke in the car had not known that he was choosing which of them would survive the night. He, meanwhile, had been driving up and down the street with his knife in his pocket. When he had been sure that she was alone, completely alone, he had drawn up and leaned across the passenger seat to talk to her through the window. His mouth had been dry as he asked for it. She had agreed a price and got in the car. They had driven down a nearby dead end where neither street lights nor passers-by would trouble them. He got what he'd asked for. Then, as she was straightening up, before he had even zipped up his flies, he had punched her, knocking her back into the car door, the back of her head banging off the window. Before she could make a sound, he'd pulled out the knife. The meaty thump of the blade in her flesh, the heat of her blood gushing over his hands, she did not even scream but gasped, moaned, sinking down in the seat as he pounded the blade into her again and again. He had torn the gold pendant from around her neck. He had not thought then about taking the ultimate trophy. A bit of her. But instead wiped his hands on her dress while she sat slumped beside him, twitching in her death throes. He had reversed out of the alleyway, trembling with fear and elation, and driven out of town with the body beside him, keeping carefully to the speed limit, looking in his rear-view mirror every few seconds. There was a place he had checked out just a few days previously, a stretch of deserted countryside in an overgrown ditch. She had made a heavy, wet thump when he rolled her into it. He had her pendant still, along with a few other souvenirs. They were his treasure. What, he wondered, would he take from the secretary? A Chinese boy near him was reading something on a tablet. Behavioral economics. Dumb psychological crap. He had seen a psychologist once, been forced to. Tell me about your mother. The little bald man had literally said it, the joke line, the cliché. They were supposed to be smart, psychologists. He'd played along for the fun of it, telling the idiot about his mother, that she was a cold, mean, screwed-up bitch. His birth had been an inconvenience, an embarrassment to her, and she wouldn't have cared if he'd lived or died. And your father? I haven't got a father, he'd said. You mean you never see him? Silence. You don't know who he is? Silence. Or you simply don't like him? He said nothing. He was tired of playing along. People were brain-dead if they fell for this kind of crap. But he had long since realized that other people were brain-dead. In any case, he told the truth. He had no father. The man who had filled that role, if you wanted to call it that, the one who had knocked him around day in, day out, a hard man but a fair man, had not fathered him. Violence and rejection, that was what family meant to him. At the same time, home was where he had learned to survive, to box clever. He had always known that he was superior, even when he'd been cowering under the kitchen table as a child. Yes. Even then he'd known that he was made of better stuff than the bastard coming at him with his big fist and his clenched face. The secretary stood up, imitating the tart with the silver hair who was just leaving with a laptop in a case. He downed his coffee in one and followed. She was so easy today, so easy. She'd lost all her wariness. She barely had the attention to spare for the platinum whore. He boarded the same tube train as the pair of them, keeping his back to the secretary, but watching her reflection from between the reaching arms of a bunch of Kiwi tourists. He found it easy to slip into the crowd behind her when she left the train. The three of them moved in procession, the silver-haired tart, the secretary, and him, up the stairs, onto the pavement, along the road to Spearmint Rhino. He was already late home, but he could not resist this. She had not stayed out after dark before, and the hold-all and the lack of engagement ring all added up to an irresistible opportunity. He would simply have to make up some story for it. The silver-haired tart disappeared into the club. The secretary slowed down and stood irresolute on the pavement. He slid out his mobile and pulled back into a shadowy doorway, watching her. Chapter 20. I never realized she was so undone. Blue Oyster Cult, Debbie Denise. Lyrics by Patti Smith. Robin had forgotten her promise to Strike that she would not stay out after dark. In fact, she had hardly registered the fact that the sun had gone down until she realized that headlights were swooping past her and that the shop windows were lit up. Platinum had changed her routine today. She would usually have been inside Spearmint Rhino for several hours already, gyrating half-naked for the benefit of strange men, not striding along the road, fully dressed in jeans, high-heeled boots, and a fringed suede jacket. Presumably she had changed her shift, but she would soon be safely gyrating around a pole, which left the question of where Robin was going to spend the night. Her mobile had been vibrating inside the pocket of her coat all day. Matthew had sent more than 30 texts. "We've got to talk. Ring me, please. Robin, we can't sort anything out if you don't talk to me." As the day had worn on, and her silence had not broken, he had started trying to call. Then the tone of his texts had changed. "Robin, you know I love you. I wish it hadn't happened. I wish I could change it, but I can't. It's you I love, Robin. I always have, and I always will." She had not texted back, or picked up his calls, or rung him. All she knew was that she could not bear to go back to the flat, not tonight. What would happen tomorrow or the next day, she had no idea. She was hungry, exhausted, and numb. Strike had become almost as importuning towards late afternoon. "Where are you? Ring me, please." She had texted him back, because she could not face talking to him either. "Can't speak. Platinum's not at work." She and Strike maintained a certain emotional distance, always. And she was afraid that if he were kind to her, she would cry, revealing the sort of weakness that he would deplore in an assistant. With virtually no cases left, with the threat of the man who had sent the leg hanging over her, she must not give Strike another reason to tell her to stay at home. He had not been satisfied with her response. "Call me ASAP." She had ignored that one on the basis that she might easily have failed to receive it, being close to the tube when he sent it, and shortly afterwards having no reception as she and Platinum rode the tube back to Tottenham Court Road. On emerging from the station, Robin found another missed call from Strike on her phone, as well as a new text from Matthew. "I need to know whether you're coming home tonight. I'm worried sick about you. Just text to tell me you're alive. That's all I'm asking." Oh, don't flatter yourself, muttered Robin. Like I'd kill myself over you. A strangely familiar, paunchy man in a suit walked past Robin, illuminated by the glow of Spearmint Rhino's canopy. It was Two Times. Robin wondered whether she imagined the self-satisfied smirk he gave her. Was he going inside to watch his girlfriend gyrate for other men? Did he get a thrill out of having his sex life documented? Precisely what kind of weirdo was he? Robin turned away. She needed to make a decision as to what to do tonight. A large man in a beanie hat appeared to be arguing into his mobile phone in a dark doorway 100 yards away. The disappearance of Platinum had robbed Robin of purpose. Where was she going to sleep? As she stood there irresolute, a group of young men walked past her, deliberately close, one of them brushing against her hold-all. She could smell Lynx and lager.
Got your costume in there, darling?
She became aware of the fact that she was standing outside a lap-dancing club. As she turned automatically in the direction of Strike's office, her mobile rang. Without thinking, she answered it.
Where the hell have you been? Said Strike's angry voice in her ear.
She barely had time to be glad that he wasn't Matthew before he said,
I've been trying to get hold of you all day. Where are you?
On Tottenham Court Road, she said, walking fast away from the still jeering men. Platinum's only just got inside, and two,
what did I tell you about not staying out after dark?
It's well lit, said Robin. She was trying to remember whether she had ever noticed a travel lodge near here. She needed somewhere clean and cheap. It must be cheap, because she was drawing on the joint account. She was determined not to spend more than she had put in.
Are you all right?
Asked Strike, slightly less aggressively. A lump rose in her throat. Fine, she said, as forcefully as she could. She was trying to be professional, to be what Strike wanted.
I'm still at the office, he said. Did you say you're on Tottenham Court Road?
I've got to go, sorry, she said in a tight, cold voice and hung up. The fear of crying had become so overwhelming that she had to end the call. She thought he had been on the verge of offering to meet her, and if they met, she would tell him everything, and she must not do that. Tears were suddenly pouring down her face. She had no one else. There. She had admitted it to herself at last. The people they had meals with at weekends, the ones they went to watch rugby with, they were all Matthew's friends, Matthew's work colleagues, Matthew's old university friends. She had nobody of her own but Strike.
Oh, God, she said, wiping her eyes and nose on the sleeve of her coat.
You all right, sweetheart?
Called a toothless tramp from a doorway. She was not sure why she ended up in the Tottenham, except the bar staff knew her, she was familiar with where the ladies was, and it was somewhere that Matthew had never been. All she wanted was a quiet corner in which she could look up cheap places to stay. She was also craving a drink, which was most unlike her. After splashing her face with cold water in the bathroom, she bought herself a glass of red wine, took it to a table, and pulled out her phone again. She had missed another call from Strike. Men at the bar were looking over at her. She knew what she must look like, tear-stained and alone, her hold-all beside her. Well, she couldn't help that. She typed into her mobile, travel lodges near Tottenham Court Road, and waited for the slow response, drinking her wine faster than perhaps she ought to have done on a virtually empty stomach. No breakfast, no lunch. A bag of crisps and an apple, consumed at the student cafe where Platinum had been studying, were all she had eaten that day. There was a travel lodge in High Holborn. That would have to do. She felt slightly calmer for knowing where she was going to spend the night. Careful not to make eye contact with any of the men at the bar, she went up to get a second glass of wine. Perhaps she ought to call her mother, she thought suddenly. But the prospect made her feel tearful all over again. She could not face Linda's love and disappointment. Not yet. A large figure in a beanie hat entered the pub, but Robin was keeping her attention determinedly on her change and her wine.